Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
Hello, and welcome to the Folklore Podcast Book Club, the strand of the Folklore Podcast where we examine books of interest to fans of folklore and chat with their authors. From classical myth to modern literature, the figure of the god Pan has fascinated and terrified the Western imagination. Panic is the name given to the peculiar feeling we experience in his presence. But the ways in which Pan has been imagined have varied wildly, fitting for a god whose name the ancients confused with the Greek word for all. Part goat and part man, Pan bridges the divide between the human and animal worlds. At times he is a dangerous and destabilizing force, at other times a representation of fertility and renewal. His portrayals reveal shifting anxieties about our own animal impulses and our relationship to nature. In his book, Pan, The Great God's Modern Return, published by Reaction Books, Paul Robichaud explores the various ways that Pan has been imagined through the centuries, tracing his development from ancient myths through early modern Europe and into the present day. Paul is Professor and Chair of English at Albert Magnus College, New Haven, Connecticut, and he joined book reviewer Hilary Wilson recently to discuss the subject of Pan.
Yeah, so hi, this is Hilary Wilson with the Folklore Podcast. I'm here with Paul Robichaud to talk about his book about Pan. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
It's an absolutely wonderful book. I'm a big fan of just about everything that Reaction has put out. So I wanted to ask you, how did you first become interested in Pan?
Yeah, I think my interest really goes back to when I was growing up, and one of my favorite books growing up was Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows, and The Piper at the Gates of Dawn was for me the kind of the most magical part of that book, and it was what I always looked forward to. So that was a big part of my childhood reading. And then as a teenager in high school, I read Paul Hawkins' The Magic of Findhorn, which is about kind of New Age community that was founded in Scotland. And part of the book is about a figure named Robert Ogilvy Crombie, who was kind of a mystic in his own way, and he had a number of encounters with Pan, and Pan offered him some insight into how the gardens they grew at Findhorn could flourish even more by kind of cooperating with the spirit world that Pan presided over, and so that that was sort of my early interest. The book sort of came about because I was reading some D.H. Lawrence, the modern English novelist, and I read Pan in America, and it got me thinking back about about Pan. And my original plan was to to kind of explore Pan and modern literature, because he started to turn up in unexpected places. But it became clear that there's just a lot more to tell. There was a much bigger story to tell about Pan. So that's what led me to write the book.
And Pan is a rather unusual figure when it comes to the Greek pantheon. You mentioned in the book that although there are many creation stories for the Greek pantheon in general, that Pan has a truly astonishing amount of them.
Yeah. He really doesn't fit well with the Greek pantheon. I mean, he's not one of the 12 Olympians. He's even Dionysus manages to get in with the Olympians, and he's kind of the closest to Pan in some ways. But Pan is never part of that group. And the Greeks really kind of tied themselves in knots trying to figure out, where did he come from and who were his parents? And one of the interesting things about their trying to figure out who his parents were was they were fairly certain who the father was early on. They sort of settled on Hermes as the most likely candidate, although other Greek sources identified Kronos, who was the father of all the Greek gods, as his father. And this right away kind of raised the question of where Pan fits in the story of the Greek gods, because he's either contemporary with Zeus or he comes later on. He's like the next generation down. But most writers felt Hermes was the most likely. Where it gets very confusing is with Pan's mother, right? And usually this is the opposite problem. We know who the mother is, but we might not be sure who the father is. But the Greeks had a lot of trouble agreeing about this. And they identified various nymphs, many of whom, we don't know very much about. Callisto was one. She's the nymph who became a bear. And another candidate was a nymph named Penelope, who was the daughter of an oak god. But the Greeks confused her with the Penelope who was Odysseus's wife. And they thought maybe Pan had acquired his monstrous appearance because she had been unfaithful to Odysseus while he was away. And in fact, Pan had 108 different fathers. And so it goes. And in the end, an early poem about him, Pan, the Homeric hymn to Pan, identified Hermes as his father and a nymph as his mother. And he's brought up into Olympus, and the gods are delighted because he looks so weird because he's got goat legs and little horns. And Dionysus laughs, and he takes the child from Hermes and welcomes him there. And they use this as an explanation for his name, because the name Pan is sounds like the same word as the Greeks used for all. And so he made all the gods laugh. And so this was one of many explanations for his name as well.
Yeah, and there were a lot of different ideas about his name and monikers that he took on, weren't there?
Yeah, he acquired a lot of different titles to kind of represent different aspects of himself. Mm-hmm. So he was known, as the deliverer or as sort of crooked backed. And some of these titles are a little mysterious. His name, the deliverer or liberator, comes from an episode at a Greek city named Troezen, where there was a plague and he appeared in a dream and he said, I just pray to me and everyone will be cured of the plague. And so he sort of delivered the city of this this plague. But his name is most likely connected to an earlier word meaning pasture. Mm. And that would sort of fit with his, goat-like appearance and his early role, which was protecting sheep in Arcadia. But because the word was so similar to this other Greek word, which is accented slightly differently, pan meaning all, the ancient Greeks very, very quickly decided that he was in some sense the god of all as well. So he has this kind of dual identity going back to ancient times.
That's interesting too, because of his appearance being part man and part animal. The idea of him encompassing all seems a little bit natural, being man's relationship to the natural world.
Yeah, right. He's a god, but he looks half human and he looks half animal. And he's also thought of as being this god of all, this nature god, really. He's identified as a nature god. And this, for the Greeks, who we know were kind of philosophical in the way they looked at things, nature for the Greeks was certainly what we think of as nature, but kind of extended into really the whole natural world, the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And so Pan is really the god of all, the whole cosmos, in fact. And he's talked about that way in a poem from later antiquity, another hymn called the Orphic Hymn to Pan, where he's the god of the whole cosmos, as well as what we understand as the natural world. And he's a real power and force that can be prayed to, but may also need to be appeased as well.
Put everybody in a little bit of difficulty when it was reported that he died.
Yes, right. He's one of several gods who are reported to have died, but he's the only god who dies and doesn't come back. In other words, he stays dead. So Dionysus, for example, dies and is resurrected. Osiris is torn into pieces and is reassembled. But Pan dies and, at least from one point of view in the ancient world, stays dead. So the story there was that, and this happened in the realm of Tiberius, the reign of Tiberius, a sailor overheard a voice that cried out, Tamas, that was the name of the sailor, Great Pan is dead. And this was reported to the emperor Tiberius, who was rather concerned to hear that a god had died, and his counselors or wise men sent out an investigation, and they confirmed that this had happened. And so the story just became circulated, and it's reported by Plutarch, the ancient writer, although a century later, essentially a Greek travel writer, he toured around Greece and wrote all about what he saw there. Pausanias reported that, in fact, Pan was still being worshipped, and in his native Arcadia, people still heard his pipes playing in the woods. But the death of Pan became a story that fascinated later readers and writers, and Christians looked at the story in different ways. They tended to view the gods as demons, mm-hmm. Who were sort of deceiving mankind. And so his death was sometimes taken as a metaphor for the death of the pagan world or the triumph of Christ. But others, other Christian writers, in fact, took the opposite view and thought that Pan was in some way identical with Christ, and that it was kind of a sort of pagan prefiguring in some way of the crucifixion. So Pan also gets identified with Christ in a kind of tradition that goes right through the Renaissance and the 17th century with the writer, the English poet John Milton, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's all these interesting branchings off over time from these ancient stories, which are interpreted and understood in different ways, which makes Pan really fascinating because he's complex. He's hard to pin down to just one thing.
Yeah, so in some ways it's all the different interpretations of him that have made the interpretation of his name, meaning all, be accurate.
Right. Yeah. Right. So he's kind of, he is everything to everybody in some ways, but definitely.
Yeah. It's very strange that he was viewed as similar or even literally being Christ when so many people know of him now as the image that the devil has been referenced as.
That was one of the things I found interesting to kind of look back at, because we have this figure of Pan and he's got his goat legs and he's got horns, and we have the popular image of the devil today. Yes. Who also typically has goat feet and horns, and Pan was understood by some Christian writers as being demonic in the ancient mm-hmm. world. So, for example, there's an ancient church historian named Eusebius, and he retells a story from a pagan writer named Porphyry, where Pan appears to some woodcutters and he freezes them immediately and they die. And Eusebius says that this shows you he's an evil, demonic kind of power. But there's not much connection made between Pan and this idea of evil, really, until much later in the 19th century. And a French occultist named Levi writes a book where he creates a figure known as Baphomet, who's a very popular occult image. And he's Pan. He's recognizably Pan, but Pan has been altered to be given female breasts, and he has a shield in front of him, and there's a torch between his horns. And Eliphas Levi, in his description of this figure, says, you know, essentially it's a symbol of wisdom. It's identical with Pan. It's identical with Baphomet, who in the 19th century was identified as a kind of idol that the Knights Templar had worshipped, mm-hmm. And so on. But this figure of Baphomet is circulated again and again all through different books about the occult and occult-themed films, horror movies, and things. And so this image of the devil being in some sense identical with this kind of Pan-like figure really gets imprinted, I think, in the public imagination. But what's interesting is when you go past the 19th century and you start looking at representations of the devil, he doesn't look very much like Pan. I mean, sometimes you'll see him with goat feet or something like that, but he's more often in the Middle Ages, for example, portrayed as a kind of assemblage of mismatching animal parts. He's a bit more like a kind of Frankenstein's monster, where you might have, you know, the tail that looks like a snake and some bat's wings and shaggy legs and so on. And it's a very different image from what we know of Pan. So I think, although it seems like this idea that the early Christians identified Pan with the devil to kind of weed ordinary pagans away from worshiping him, it seems like that makes some sense until we sort of look at how the devil was portrayed and thought of and written about. And that seems to be a much more recent phenomenon, in fact.
Yeah, that was one of the more surprising things from the book. Yeah, I had interviewed Thomas Honegger last year, and so many of the depictions of the devil in the medieval ages were just, like you were saying, they were assemblages of animals. They were draconic, essentially. You know, you'd recognize Satan because he would have scales. And then all of a sudden he becomes a shaggy goat figure, which...
Right.
Yeah. It's just strange. I found it really interesting that the goats were far more associated with lust, you know, than they were with anything outright demoniacal or, you know, anything like that. Because then you have this idea that Pan is lust to a certain extent, but not satanic.
Yeah. And I think the goat aspect of Pan was associated with lust, going back to the ancient world as well. Goats, I guess, are rather randy animals, and so for the ancients, that seemed like a fitting symbol. Satan had reptilian associations, I think, because of the Bible, where he appears in Eden as a serpent. So it kind of made some sense for him to be reptilian. And one thing I wonder about is, in the 19th century, as we know, you know, the Victorians had a very stern attitude towards human sexuality, and was a source of temptation and sin outside of marriage in Victorian culture. And I can't help but wonder if some of those attitudes shaped the way the Victorians imagined the devil as being really closely connected with lust, with sexual desire and things like that. And if that played some role in the shifting perception of the devil's appearance.
that was something that I was curious about when I was reading your book as well, because you had written about how Pan had become almost a coded way for writers to talk about their own sexuality, you know, in particular, you know, homosexual men. So then if that was being picked up in more modern culture, it would make sense for those sensibilities to then begin to cast Pan in a more negative light.
Yeah. And this was particularly true kind of starting in the 1890s, where writers like Oscar Wilde, for example, sort of celebrate Pan as the embodiment of freedom, of, you know, a kind of liberated sensibility. Pan's own sexuality was kind of ambiguous in the ancient world. I mean, there's depictions of him and stories of him attempting to seduce or rape nymphs who are always female. But there's also an ancient story about Pan attempting to seduce a young shepherd, a young man. And that is actually depicted on an ancient Greek vase, for example. So Pan had this association with gay desire as well as sort of straight desire going back to the ancient world. And for writers like Wilde and other decadent writers, he kind of symbolized a sort of forbidden sexuality, but also embodied the freedom of that as well. So that made him a popular figure in the decades around 1890 to about 1910.
And especially later for, you know, writers like Aleister Crowley, who decided to pick up on that image and amplify it even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Aleister Crowley, that whole kind of literary cultural world of Pan is very, very much in the background for him. And so he's, you know, he's familiar with the older traditions, I think, of Pan, but it is filtered through that world of the 1890s, where, you know, Pan is to some extent symbolic of forbidden desire and perhaps forbidden practices as well. Definitely.
Yeah, I found that I found that entire idea of the, you know, modern occult revival of Pan worship not exactly worship, but invocations, extremely interesting, because although there is that, you know, aspect of forbidden desire of the darker side of Pan, so much of it was focused more on the natural world, you know, as a whole, like you were talking about earlier with Pan's helpful gardening tips.
Right, Pan's helpful gardening tips, right. And yet there was this other side of Pan. If we think back to another writer from the 1890s, Arthur Machen, and his story, The Great God Pan. And that is tapping into another very ancient tradition regarding Pan. Pan is a source of terror. And in the ancient world, the main thing Pan was known for was inspiring terror. You knew Pan was present if you were walking through the forest and you were suddenly overcome by a sense of dread or terror, or your animals were, you know, your animals suddenly bolt. Well, it's because Pan is there inspiring them, maybe mischievously, with a sense of fear. But, you know, Machen's Pan is both the kind of cosmic Pan. He's a god sort of beyond everything, something. Machen doesn't use this word, but there's something kind of extra dimensional about him, you know, and he's brought into this world, and his avatar, his representative in the world, engages in all kinds of unspeakable practices, which, you know, Victorians couldn't write about, but might have imagined. You know, he's represented by a woman, in fact. So, you know, again, there's this kind of exploration of gender and gender identities there. Helen Vaughan is the figure in The Great God Pan, who is in some sense Pan's daughter. And she embodies all kinds of terrifying perversions and murderous impulses. And so you have, on the one hand, these very idyllic portrayals of Pan, like the Piper at the Gates of Dawn in Kenneth Graham's novel. And then you have this other tradition of portraying Pan as a source of terror. And the occult revival sometimes draws a bit on both, I think. I mean, being the occult, I think there's definitely an attraction to that darker, more powerful side of Pan. But the notion of Pan as a benevolent god, or at least potentially benevolent god, and a god of nature, really becomes integrated into modern witchcraft as well.
One of the things that I was thinking about, I think it was in Ogilby's account of meeting Pan, you know, he mentioned that the challenge was to be able to look upon Pan and not be afraid, you know, to see that face and not run in terror. And if you were able to do that, then Pan would continue to work with you. And that was something that other writers also mentioned in meeting with Pan, you know, in their visions.
Yeah, right. So for Ogilvy, the terror that Pan inspires is not kind of the be all and end all of Pan, but it's kind of a test. It's really an initiatory sort of test. And Ogilvy is an interesting case because he has these stories that he sort of circulated publicly in lectures that were recorded and distributed. But a few years ago, 2013, I think his private journals were published, his kind of magical journals where he recorded his practices and experiences and so on. And what's fascinating looking at them is that far from sort of exaggerating his accounts for a public audience, he in fact kept a lot of it to himself. And a lot of his private experiences were ones where, for example, Pan might appear to him in the form of a snake or a serpent and try to squeeze him and frighten him in some ways. And there are these repeated examples in these sorts of visionary experiences he records where Pan is testing him by trying to frighten him. And as he's able to show that he's not really afraid of Pan, he really wants to know Pan and learn from him, he's able to receive, you know, some of the teachings and so on that Pan receives. And there are kind of parallel examples. An occultist, a British occultist from the early, active in the early 70s, named Leo Vinci, talks about going on a sort of inner journey to visit Pan. And there again, he's tested. He has to go through a very long journey and overcome the sense of fear that Pan inspires when he first encounters him. So different, different writers, different, you know, sort of mystics or cult practitioners have imagined Pan's ability to instill fear in different ways, but it's often a step towards acquiring greater wisdom.
There was an interview, well, a call-in interview on Coast to Coast AM back in 2010. Where an occultist had talked about her coven trying to summon Pan one night. And they were singing and they were dancing to try to summon him. And all of a sudden, from the mountain nearby, they heard an unearthly howl and then the sound of flutes. And they knew that it had worked, but they were far too terrified to actually do anything. So they just ran away. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about that.
That's really fascinating.
You know, if you can manage to overcome that initial flight response, then you get the wisdom. But if you can't, then you're just kind of stuck running from Pan. And that's just interesting to me.
It is. And I think whatever we sort of make of these encounters, these experiences, there does seem to be a kind of deeper wisdom in that, you know, that if we respond to experience, if we respond to the unfamiliar in a way that leads us to flee from it or perhaps even an attack, you know, that sort of flight or fight response, we're not going to benefit from it in any way. We're not going to be able to understand it. So, so there is a sense in which overcoming that kind of basic primal response is necessary if we're going to learn, really, if we're going to understand something that is strange, something that is unfamiliar to us.
I think that's also a lot of the way that people tend to react to the natural world in general. You know, you tend to be afraid of something that you don't understand. But if you overcome that fear to face it, then you have the potential for great wisdom. And if you don't, then you'll just continue running.
Right. Yeah. Whatever we can learn from nature requires us to overcome some of those basic responses we have. You know, we have to be willing to be present and to experience, to see, to touch, maybe even to taste, you know, if we're going to gain knowledge, gain understanding about the natural world.
I thought that the Piper at the Gates of Dawn chapter of Wind in the Willows really encompassed that mixture of fear and awe and love, ultimately. And I was really surprised to learn that American copies tend to just excise that chapter entirely.
Yeah, and I don't know how common this is, but I have seen a number of editions in recent years where the chapter is simply taken out. It's an interesting chapter to think about Graham as a writer, because it was the last thing he wrote for Wind in the Willows, and so he added it on. But there is a sense in which it's not really integral to the plot. You know, it's
gorgeous,
it is. I mean, I think it adds so much. Like even thinking, you know, thinking about the animals in that book, it gives them this whole inner life, this kind of spiritual communion, this spiritual depth, I think, that we don't otherwise have. But I think, again, the connections that Pan has in the popular imagination, the horns and the hooves with the devil, I think clearly some publishers felt that was troubling for some readers. E.H. Shepherd, who illustrated the book back in the 1930s, he has a wonderful image of the Piper, but he's rather devilish looking. He's got this sort of thin mustache going up. And I had never seen that image until a few years ago, although I'd seen an American edition of the book with his illustrations many times. So there's something, you know, from a certain point of view, there's still something threatening about Pan, something a little wild and dangerous.
I was the most surprising thing in the book to me was reading about the idea that Syd Barrett of Pink Floyd had encountered Pan. I actually bought my copy of Wind in the Willows the day that he died, because I knew that he was a big fan of that book and I wanted to read it myself. So hearing that he had, you know, had this encounter was startling to me, but it also made a disturbing amount of sense for his tragic story.
Yeah, and so, you know, Syd Barrett, the original singer in Pink Floyd, he suffered from mental illness. His mental illness was probably almost certainly aggravated by his drug use, particularly psychedelics. In the 60s, his manager Alan King reported that Pan had given a vision. He had appeared to Syd Barrett in a vision and had opened up the cosmos and sort of shown him the inner workings of the natural world. And if you've sort of read around Pan, that seems like a really dangerous thing to experience.
Oh, yeah.
He's seeing into nature. He's seeing how it works. And, Alan King doesn't sort of make the connection, but even in a kind of superficial way, I think we can see that Syd Barrett as an artist, he was a tortured man, and he saw really deeply into things, maybe too deeply in so many ways.
Yeah, it really reframed his work for me, listening to it, thinking about, you know, him having that sort of an experience, because so much of his music is around the natural world and having these kinds of playful references to things. So it just was very strange, and it just really was reminding me of, you know, even Arthur Machen's work. That mixture of like playfulness and deviousness, but also beauty and fear. It all really melts together well. And I think that's just such a neat way to look through at his work.
Yeah, and with Machen too, I mean, Pan really is deeply tied to the inner workings of the universe, and contains the secrets of life, really, and of generation. And he both encompasses and is beyond what we understand by sexual difference and so on, and is a source of terror to all who witness him, in whatever form, in Machen's story. And the Syd Barrett anecdote, Alan King doesn't record that Barrett was terrified, which is kind of interesting. He doesn't really record his reaction at all, but clearly this was a profound and transformative experience for Syd Barrett. And I think you're right to connect it with some of the playful qualities in his music, but also that sense of wonder and openness to the natural world as well, the cosmic dimensions of life.
It clearly affected him enough to change the title of his album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn.
Yeah, right. And again, I think I make this comment in the book, but like Kenneth Graham, it's a very last minute addition. Yeah. The Piper at the Gates of Dawn was going to be called Projector, which is kind of a cool name for an album, but Piper at the Gates of Dawn adds this whole other kind of dimension to it. And there's no explicit reference to Pan or Wind in the Willows in the album itself, but the title, you know, makes that connection and does present the tracks, the music in a different context, a different frame.
Yeah, it also was kind of giving me a pause with Syd Barrett's first solo album being titled The Madcap Laughs, because that's also just a little bit reminiscent of Pan and the laughter that, you know, accompanied him being brought to Olympus.
Right. Yeah.
It's just this strange cast.
It is. Yeah. Pan working his mischief once again.
Yeah, it just was really fascinating to me, but I absolutely loved your book. I was curious, is there anything new that you're working on?
I think I'm in a fallow period at the moment. I'm thinking of I have a few ideas in mind, but I'm just taking a rest after Pan and taking some time to gather my thoughts and focus on a few other things.
I can understand needing one after diving as deep as you did into everything.
You can't looking into the secrets of nature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Paul for joining us to chat about Pan and to Hilary for reviewing his book. You can find the review in the book reviews section of the Folklore Podcast website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com. The Folklore Podcast and the Book Club are independent podcasts aiming to collect and preserve folklore materials for the future, alongside other projects such as the Folklore Library and Archive and the Folklore Network. Find out more about all of our work on our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com, where you can also join our free occasional e-newsletter for more in-depth news. Please tell your friends about our content and share our posts and episodes in whatever online spaces you use. You can follow us on Twitter at FolklorePod, and we're also on Instagram and Facebook. We try to avoid adverts in our shows to keep to the topics in hand, but this comes at a cost. If you want to help us continue, please visit www.thefolklorepodcast.com/support, where you can find links to our Patreon page and other information. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.